longer, I'd like to welcome and introduce Norm A. from Monrovia, California. Norm?
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Good evening, folks. My name's Norm, and I'm an alcoholic. Yeah. And I'm extremely happy to have the opportunity to be here and to participate. And I'd like to thank Jim, the program chairman, for the invitation, for the opportunity to come here to share my experience, strength, and hope with you folks that I can come by another day of sobriety. And also have the opportunity to thank the people that shared their hospitality and their time with us. And that's Bobby here that picked us at the airport, and Larry that run us out for a late breakfast, and for Chink and Ed, and for the dinner and the companionship that we've had the opportunity to experience, being able to run into some old friends that I haven't seen for a long time, and the people from Tulsa and points outside. And I'm happy just to have the opportunity to be here. I'm also happy to have the opportunity to be here and to welcome all of the new people that are here for the first, oh, say, 30 days in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say, you know, that the new people, I'm sure there are some here. This time of year, you know, in Los Angeles, we get a hell of a lot of new people coming in. We're moving through the light wine and beer season about now. We get a lot of fallouts out there. That heat, you know, kind of brings them in. And the last of the Christmas holdouts are now coming through. We get a lot of them coming in about this time. To all of the new people that are here this evening, why, you're sure welcome. And being new, I'm sure you realize, recognize that you've now associated yourself with one of the most popular, unpopular fellowships in the world. You know, nobody begins his life wanting to become an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's not a hell of a lot of class to being an alcoholic and a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when I came in, there wasn't any status connected with it. They didn't issue out pins that identified you as a 32nd degree alcoholic. You know, you run all over town showing a pin. Everybody was delighted. Jesus, you're going to AA. Man, that's great. Hell of a deal, AA, isn't it? Yeah, well, that... Who looks forward to becoming an alcoholic? Nobody that I know of. Who goes down to his high school counselor and you sit down and he says, "What would you like to be?" And I said, "An alcoholic." Well, he said, "Marvelous, I got a hell of a program for jackasses, you know." So I took their program and I ripped that city out there for 15 years and ended up in AA. Now, that isn't it. I resisted this program like everybody else, right down to the bitter end. Because the day before I came to the program, like you, I'm not an alcoholic. Hell, I'm a heavy drinker and a victim of unusual circumstances, rotten drivers and bad whiskey, but man, I ain't no alcoholic. Now, I ain't going to AA. And by God, you take it right down to the wire until you can't go any farther. See, you lay it on the floor, and you finally say, "I think I have a problem." Yeah. And you surrender, and you come in, and you buy the package. It now becomes now the most popular program in your life. And I sincerely hope, and say without reservation, that to all of the new people that are sitting here this evening, I hope to God the day will come in your life when you too can say, "It's the most popular program in my life." And to qualify that beginning statement that I made for the benefit of the new people that are here tonight, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm not by any stretch of the imagination an authority or a consultant on the program Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an example, good or bad, that AA works. That it has been necessary for me to take a drink, steal anything, or go to jail now for 27 years and 6 months. And I'm sure nobody here tonight's impressed. And I can tell. What the hell? Yeah. But I am, obviously. I never brought it up, right? And you never know. I've been talking about it for years. We might get a pension program going here in AA, by God. And if we ever do, old Joe and I, we want to get credit for all our time. So we bring it up, you know, anytime we have the opportunity. And if I don't have the opportunity, I'm going to tell you about it anyway. But to the new people who are sitting out there tonight, it's a tough thing to digest when you hear people talking about terms of sobriety. You know, anybody that's been around for maybe 6 months or a year, that's a hell of a long time, and I can recognize and understand it. I can still remember sitting that first AA meeting. At that time, I was 29 years old. And the guy stood up in front of the group that night. And he said, "I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, steal anything, and go to jail now for 9.5 years." And my reaction to him was, "He is the biggest liar I've ever heard." Because there isn't any way that a guy can cut it out there for 9.5 years. 9.5 years he's been out there in that rotten jungle, dealing with those lousy people, meeting his responsibilities, being honest. He hadn't stolen anything. He hadn't had a hooker now in 9.5 years. And I was, that's a drink in L.A. I don't know what the heck it is here, but you know. At least my generation, it was a drink. He hadn't had a drink for 9.5 years, and I was overwhelmed with this thing. You know, if the guy had stood up there and said, "I hadn't had any booze, now I haven't been drunk for 12, 14 months, I'd have gone for that. I thought, what the hell, I could cut 14 months maybe. I remember one time it had been 11.5 months, I hadn't had a thing to drink. I'd been in jail. And I'd, it wasn't a pleasant thing, but I was able to get through that, and I felt I might be able to stretch it out. But I couldn't go for the next 9.5 years, and I was consumed with it. It became a 9.5 year program, an obsession. What am I going to do for the next 9.5 years, you know? But my salvation was that I kept going to meetings. And if I'm going to say anything tonight that's significant for the new people here, why, you got to get going to them meetings. Because you got a lot of questions. And you're not going to find the questions in any books necessarily. You're going to find it in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to find it from the people. And I kept going to the meetings, and the people that were there convinced me past a shadow of a doubt that I didn't have to be concerned with the next 9.5 years. That all I had to take care of was right now, because that's all I had.
And that's really
all I have is right now. I couldn't change what happened a couple of hours ago. I may want to, but I couldn't. And I can't tell you for sure what's going down a couple of hours from now. If I got anything going in my life, it's right now, and being able to get all I can get now. Man, get it good, bad, or indifferent. Because I may not be around later on. Or maybe I'm not going to be around later on. So if it's going through, get a hold of it. Grab it. Being able to live in the now. I found out I could live in the week. And then a month and a year. And before you knew it, why, 27 have run by. It was the other day. That's how fast. That fast it went. It was just the other day. I'm sitting there in those AA meetings going through the mental gymnastics that every alcoholic who is new goes through, wondering, why am I an alcoholic? Of all the things I could have been. As I said, why am I an alky? I come from a family of heavy drinkers. I had good training out there. My people knew a lot about booze. They weren't overly intelligent. They were Irish-Italian, obviously. They wouldn't be too smart. They talked a lot with their hands. They were too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash, and that'd take care of us, you know. For a hell of a long time. We were in the middle. But the one thing we did know, we knew a great deal about booze. We knew how to make it, and we did. The Italians made it, the Irish drank it, and I got to AA, and that's about the way it went, you see. But in the beginning, I felt that my alcoholism was created by my family and by my environment, the fact that I'm from Los Angeles, and I thought anybody from L.A. has got to be hacked one way or another. But L.A. is a city, isn't it? And you can get out of anywhere you want to get out of if you want it bad enough and you're willing to make the sacrifices to get it to do it. People, places, and things do not make me alcoholic. And that's my own opinion. I am alcoholic because I drank too much whiskey. And I figured that out by myself. I thought, Jesus, what a hell of a decision that was. Yeah, man, it was that whiskey I drank out there that created my trouble. And I'm the guy that did the drinking, so when you get right down to it, hell, I'm the problem. And that hasn't changed up to and including today. The biggest enemy I got, including today, is me. Because no matter where I go, I'm the first guy to get there, right? Yeah. I don't think any of us had to call somebody up and say, will you please come down and help me? I want to get it screwed up. Oh, no. No, I'm able to take care of that all right. Now, I can overreact to any situation, anywhere, anytime. I don't need anybody out there to help me. And that qualification I had long before I ever took a drink. I'm a rationalizer, a justifier, a compromiser, and I got a rotten attitude. Man, you don't need much more than that, do you, huh? I traveled half the world in half my life. I made a complete ass of myself. I spent money I didn't have buying things I didn't need, trying to impress people I didn't like. I sat around them gin mills and I drove the Cadillacs up and down the bar night after night after night. Talked in millions, spent in thousands. Never had a dollar in my pocket. Yeah. Built the castles in the air and formed the corporations and wondered what all the poor people were doing because the big money was there. And when them high rollers said, what do you do? I said, man, I do it all. Jesus, I'm the general manager of the universe. That's what I am. Yeah. And I felt they were truly impressed with all this that I was laying on them, you know. I spent a lifetime out there impressing a bunch of people I never met in my life that I was something I wasn't. Because I never knew what I wanted to be until I got to AA. And what I wanted to be is to be sober. And to be myself. And if I don't get any more than that, what the heck, I'm overpaid. A long time out there being everybody else, justifying my existence, compromising my life, and doing things that I really didn't want to do. I heard a story many years ago in Texas. And a guy told the story of my life. This old Texan, he didn't know it at the time, but this old Texican, he says, he told his story. It was clean, so I'm going to repeat it. And it was about the blacksmith. You may have heard it. It's worth repeating. About the blacksmith is making a horseshoe. And he pounds out that horseshoe. He takes it out of a forge and he's pounding it out and it's red hot. And he throws it down the ground. And there's an old cowboy standing there. He's watching the whole deal. And he reaches down and he picks up the horseshoe. Quick, he throws it back down the ground. And the old blacksmith turned to him and he said, hot, wasn't it? And the old cowboy said, no, it doesn't take me long to look at a horseshoe.
kind of gets grows on you a little there. And I thought, Jesus, that's the story of my life. I run around justifying the stupidity of my life. That's what I did. Yeah. Picking up the hot horseshoes. The guy, you know, I'm laying on the street. He says, you're drunk there in the street. Oh, no, no. I love streets, man. You don't understand. And so if you're new here this evening, you might give that a little thought. And you might buy the package that's available to you here. And you might take it out there with me tomorrow. And you might spend a day with me just being sober and being yourself. It's one hell of an experience. It's an experience I got to believe that no alcoholic should be without. Tonight, to tell you just briefly a little bit about what I was like, what happened, what I'm trying to be like today, what the program of AA means to me, some things that I've used to stay sober. What I'm like. I've told you a great deal. I'm a guy with a bad attitude. And you got a bad attitude, it's just a matter of you have a lot of bad trouble. Isn't that the way it is? You wake up in the morning, you got a rotten attitude. What's the day? It's rotten now. If you work at it, you can go a week or a month. I went a whole year out there with that bad attitude. Yeah, I ain't going to change. Sure, I've got that hard head, that reverting back. Sure, making money's good, but getting even's better, isn't it? Sure. And that attitude, you see, got me in trouble before I ever took a drink. I was arrested in 1939. Not because I was drinking, because I was too young. I was stealing. I'm a thief by trade and alcoholic by absorption. I was the general manager and vice president of all the outside operations of the Midnight Auto Supply in the San Gabriel Valley. I was in the car business. I moved a lot of cars. I moved car parts, and then it got to be a job to gather up all that crap. We just stole cars, and I enjoyed every loving minute. It was the best job I ever had. You didn't need any money to get into it. You didn't carry any inventory, and everything you turned was at 100% profit. How the hell are you going to beat that deal, see? Yeah, but it's illegal. That was the problem. The guy said about me years ago, he says, old Norm, if it was too big to carry, he laid down beside it and claimed it. And that was about the way it was. But I learned the old law of retribution comes in. You know, what's going out is coming back, man. You're going to play, you got to pay. I understand that today, and I'll buy it just the way it is. I don't think it's very good, but I'll buy it. And I went in front of a judge who sent me to jail because I'd committed some crimes out there on the city street, and that's the way it should be. And I went to pay for the crimes. And I did some time. And I got a release. Got put on probation. Some juice got working. I'm an advocate and a believer that the world runs on juice. I've had a lot of argument with my AA friends, but I believe it. If you know somebody that knows somebody, you work something out. My people are Irish-Italian. They got to know somebody. You know that. And something moved. And the next thing you know, I'm on the street. Now, I didn't have a change of attitude. I didn't think that, you know... thank anybody. I felt they were late. I didn't think I'd be, you know, should have been out there anyway. That giant rationale. I came out and looking for the fantasy land of which I found. The fantasy land of my life, it started in about 1940. It was booze. It was Easter week in L.A., Easter week Balboa Beach, the Rendezvous Ballroom, Stan Kenton, and Padre Beer. That's where it all got going. We drink a little Padre, get a little buzz on, go in the dance hall, dance with the dollies, act four times drunker what we were, breathe on them girls, or, you know, you got to let them know, don't you? Yeah, baby, got a little booze out there. The big man's in from Los Angeles is what it is. Yeah, you know, it was fun. It was a heck of a lot of fun. In the beginning, I had fun. I didn't get in any trouble. I didn't wake up in the morning, have to have something to drink. I was not an alcoholic. I ground it out. It was the dance halls and the bands. The Trianon and Southgate, Cotton Club in Culver City, Pasadena Civic, and I'd go on and on. I moved out of that Padre, though, because I never did enough. It took a lot to get going. From Padre, I went to the Rainier Ale, the old Green Death. From the Green Death, I went to whiskey, and there it was. I didn't need any more than whiskey. Whiskey did it. Man, whiskey got me downtown. That's what I want to be. I want to be downtown. Jesus, and I don't want to be downtown just a little while. I want to get there right now. And that's one thing about whiskey. It gets your attention, don't it? Man, it gets you going. I even got to the point in my life where I enjoyed the taste of it. In the beginning, it was a little difficult. I'll be the first to admit. When you're young and you're training out there, it's tough that... I broke in on 10 high, and it was rotten. I don't think they made anything worse than 10 high. And man, that baby burned all the way. It burned going and coming. It ran out my nose and made my eyes water a lot. But I hung in. And I think that's important. If you're going to be an alcoholic, man, you don't give up because you throw up a little. Stay in there, boy. Yeah. And the day comes when you can drink a pint of whiskey and you don't heave anymore, and it kind of gives you a sense of well-being. And one thing to be said about cheap whiskey, when you throw it up, you don't lose much, right? Yeah. But you know, my personality started doing the flip-flop then. I started doing things I'd never done in my life. Whiskey brought something out of me that I never knew was there. And I did a lot of crazy things. And now I'm starting to get one jam after another. And before you know it, it's the end of 1941. I'm in a bad jam. I violated my probation. But the probation department gave me the opportunity to join the Navy, get in the service. Said one way or another, we want you out of L.A. And so I joined the Navy in January 1942. We were in a state of war. I was in a state of shock. That's the understatement. I went in the Navy because I was going to change everything. Everything was going to work out. I was going to stay for 20 years. I was going to get educated. I was going to be the youngest lieutenant commander the Navy ever had. I was going to do all that, and I ended up being the oldest seaman they ever had in. You see, I went into seaman, and 4 years later, I came out a seaman. And people said, that's hard to do, but you know, not really. You put your mind to it, you can do it all right. Yeah. And obviously, none of this was intentional. It was just the way I was operating. I was very, very lucky because I didn't get a kick out. I've always lived on the edge, just one step away from total disaster. I didn't get the kick out. I was able to stay clean long enough to fulfill a commitment of 4 years. I did have 3 court-martials, a deck, a summary, and a general court. I did do 11 and a half months in a Navy brig up in the top of Goat Island off a general court-martial. I had 70, 80 days solitary confinement on bread and water at different intervals. I had maybe 10, 11 captain's mass. I had some other miscellaneous things that aren't important. But all of it directly due to booze. No drinking, no trouble. Drinking, a lot of trouble. So consequently, when I was aboard ship, I did a good job. Because I like ships, and I like the sea. And I worked hard. And I think that's the story of alcoholics, isn't it? An alky likes something, he goes good at it. An alcoholic, he's got to work hard. He's got to work 25% harder than anybody else just to stay even out there. Isn't that the way it is? Because he's always coming from behind. Hell, you always got the heat on. In order to get the heat off, you got to go like hell. The best day an alcoholic has is Tuesday, because he missed Monday. He goes, right? Got to get that heat off out there, right? Heat on, heat off. The story of my life. God almighty.
So consequently, I was aboard ship. Well, I stayed pretty clean because I liked the job I was doing there and I liked the ships. Sure, I got drunk once in a while aboard ship. I drank the Sneaky Pete, the fermented coconut juice, and a little Vitalis, a little Aquavalva, a little de-icer fluid out of the wings of the planes, a little of that. But I was able to always kind of keep the thing in check because if for some reason in the back of my mind it says, get in a jam here and they're going to bust you, you'll get a BCD and you do some hard time and didn't want to do it. So I survived. I came out of the service on Christmas Eve in 1945. I'm an alcoholic. No question about it. I've crossed the invisible line from the social aspect of drinking to the compulsive area where one's too many and a thousand aren't enough. Looking out there for that answer to live in that quart of whiskey and I can't get my hands on it. Trying to drink like my old man and my brothers and the guys I'm running with. Can't find it. I can use the program in 1946. Could have used it maybe in 1943. I don't really know when I crossed that invisible line. I do know in 1946, though, the program was brought to my attention. I got picked up in a rotten town over in California called Pasadena. It's a bad town, I might add. They got a lot of bad policemen and they got a bad judge. And no matter what I did, it was always wrong and I was always in the slammer there. All of my, part of my juvenile life, part of my adult life, and I seemed like it was like a magnet used to suck me back in. And in 1946, I got picked up 4 times. I got 2 502s, which is drunk driving, 2 plain drunk arrests. I'm standing in front of a judge that I know like a father. And he had never lied to me in his life, never. And he said, a year suspended, 3 years probation. Now, and the next time you get in this town and you're doing any drinking, you're violated. He said, you don't even have to drink. All you've got to do is be found out that you're in a place that serves or sells alcoholic beverages and you're violated. You're going back to jail. So I left that court. And I said to myself, self, don't drink in Pasadena. Now, I'm not... It doesn't take a mental giant to figure that out, does it? And I went on my way for, 2-3 months. Did a little drinking, but didn't get drunk. Getting drunk in other towns. One night I'm about half smashed, and I committed a cardinal sin. I began to think. And that's a bad deal for an alcoholic. You should think or drink, but you should never do them both at the same time. Never. Now, I got to thinking about that rotten judge in that lousy town. It's a free country, and I'm a veteran. What the hell, I want to go to Pasadena. I'm going to Pasadena. And by God, I went to Pasadena. I'll show him. And I got a load on, it wouldn't wait, and I picked up a buddy of mine, we got out, and we got in my car, we're heading for Eagle Rock for an after-hours joint, and the next thing you know, the car's making a left turn in front of me, and I can't see it, and I slammed into it.
I'm frightened. I'm on the edge again. I'm always frightened. And the only thing I can think about is to get the hell out of there. And I ran from the scene of the accident. When they picked me up, why, I'm maybe 2-3 blocks away. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm in jail. I read the book and slip, and it's a 501 felony, drunk driving, hit and run, bodily injury involved. And but for the grace of God that looks after damn fools and drunks, four folks didn't die in the city street that night. Because you know and I know alcoholism is a game of seconds and inches, isn't it? A few inches, a few seconds, a snap of the finger. That's all it is, the division between total disaster. That night, if I'd have been over 3.5 feet, just that fraction of a second of the rate of speed I was traveling at had killed all four people in that auto. I know that today. I recognize I'm very fortunate. And I remember when they come and got me, and I'm in a high-power tank, and they load me in the elevator. And I stand there with a bunch of other alkies, and we're getting that used bourbon back and forth. You know how. Oh, Jesus. That elevator drops four floors. There you go. There you are. And they run you out like a lot of cattle, and you sit in that room, and you wait for them to call your name, and they call your name, and you walk through the courtroom. And there's 170 miles through that courtroom, and you think everybody's staring at you. You stand there in front of the judge, and you hear the judge tell you what kind of guy you are, and then he sends you to jail. And what he didn't know, what I didn't know, was that in that city jail, I was to share a cell with a man who was going to AA. God moving in strange and mysterious ways, and no matter what I do, I don't do. It's going to work out that way anyway. Here I am back to a town that I said I'll never go back to get drunk, to hit a car, to end up in jail. With one man, out of 250, one man got out of jail once a week to go to AA, and he planted the seed. It was that long, that short. When it gets tough today, you know, I don't think I can stand it out there in that street. When everything seems to be going bad, I like to reach back. I say, God, give me the strength to remember who the hell I am and where I came from and what it took to bring me to that point in my life. Let me remember the year of 46 when I'm laying in that slammer or standing in front of the judge when I thought I'd killed somebody. Or let me remember 51 and I'm laying down in Big Spring, Texas in that jail down there. It's a dirt floor and the cockroaches are running over your head. And you get nothing to eat for 2 days. They bring you water. And I was in one hell of a jam down there. And if I think it's tough today, God give me the strength to remember when it was tough out there. Let me remember what it used to be like. Let me also recognize that how many chances you're going to get. And I don't stay sober from the fear of it, but a guy be a darn fool not to know how lucky is he. How lucky can I be that I'll hear about a program in 1946? The odds are now running against me. In 1946, to sit there once a week and listen to a guy talk about AA, and that's all going in. I'm doing nothing about the program because I didn't believe I was the alcoholic at that time. And I told him, I said, Sullivan, I'm not going to an AA meeting with you because I'm not an alcoholic. You don't understand, man, I'm too young. Your case is much different. I get to be as old as you. I'll think about it. What the hell, you're 36. You're over the hill, Sully. You don't have much to offer anybody. And I really felt that way. And I've eaten those words several thousand times. You really don't hit it until you're 57. You know that, don't you? Yeah. Anyway, I left that city jail and I went back out. And from time to time in the next 8 years, I used to wonder what the hell ever happened to Sully. In that 8 years, I went to work for one of the largest construction firms in the world. I had the opportunity to stay 11 years with these people. I was at the right place at the right time. Owned and operated by 3 Yugoslavs that came from the old country. I swear to God, they made all their money with hard work and good whiskey. I had picked up some knowledge of hydraulics and steam, explosives while I was in the service, and I was able to parlay this. At the right place, at the right time. In a very short period of time, I moved on up. From an equipment operator to a foreman to a general foreman to a superintendent in charge of all the high-pressure water transmission lines and earthwork that company had in the 11 western states. Troubleshooter. Made it before I was 29 years old, all the way up the ladder, going fast and running by and stepping on anybody I can, huh? And drinking that whiskey. Man, I'm drinking better whiskey now, and I'm drinking it in better joints. The only problem is that I had a little setback. It kind of held me back a little. I had met and married a red-headed Irish woman. Some of you better. She has a violent temper, a rotten disposition, yelled at me all the time, and never recognized what a sensitive person I was. All alcoholics are sensitive. You know that if you're an alcoholic. God, you're out there and you're gone for about 3 days and you come home and you're extremely tired. You've been busy, busy out there, right? You put a lot of deals together. And when you walk in the house, you want to be greeted with a little love, affection, and understanding. Who the hell wants to be met with that crap? You're drunk again. before she has smelled your breath. I used to call her on the phone, and she'd say, "You're drinking, aren't you?" And I used to wonder, how in the hell does she know? Yeah, I knew she was good, but she couldn't smell it through the phone. There wasn't any way. I got so paranoid, I thought she'd hired people to follow me. I used to sit around and look, where the hell are they, them guys out there? Yeah. And then I'd sneak out the back door at them gin mills to hide from the people who weren't there. It takes a lot of hard work to be an alcoholic, you know that? Yeah. Now, God, these conversations we'd have. You're drunk again. Who, me? Like 30 guys are with me. I know who she's talking to, you know. She'd say, "Yeah, you." Then I'd hit her with a big one. I say, "Do you know who you're talking to? I'm old Norm, baby. That's who the hell I am. And don't you ever forget that. I'm trying to let her in on a good deal." Yeah. Sure. She knows the deal. We're being foreclosed out of the house. Her wardrobe, she's standing in it right there. She knows the deal, yeah. But she never said that. She would just mimic me. "I'm old Norm. That's who I am. Ha, 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 ha." That's very degrading in front of one of your best friends, isn't it? You know, your new business partner. You met him in the bar last night. You've asked him home. And the reason he's coming home with me is, hell, he don't want to go home alone either. He's scared of his wife, you know. And there you stand, the blind leading the blind. You know, "Tell her, Norm, tell her, boy, yeah. All right, I'm going to tell her. That's what I'm going to do. All right, Red, you've embarrassed me in front of my best friend. And I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. Either you apologize or I'm leaving this dump and I'm not coming back. And what do you think of that?" And she would go down the hall hysterical as she picked up all my clothes and tossed them out, right? So you got to save face in front of your friend that you can't think of his name. You got to pick up them clothes, and you got to pack them out to the car, in and out, loading up that car, huh? That old clothes-packing alcoholic. Jesus, he's the joy to the neighborhood out there. Oh, yeah. On a Sunday evening, instead of watching Gunsmoke, you can watch the alcoholic load his car up out there, huh? Loading up his car. Sitting in the front seat, honking his horn. Honk, honk, you know. Notifying the neighbors, "I'm going, Charlie. She did it. She did it again, and I ain't never coming back." Zoom, off into the sunset, drives the alcoholic. Never to return. A couple of days later, you wake up in the front seat of your car, right? The reason you're sleeping in the car is you haven't got money to sleep anywhere else. There's got to be some car sleepers here tonight, I'm sure. And you know, it helped get you to AA, that car sleeping. God, that's bad. You got your head screwed up under the armrest, the door handle in your ear, huh? You ever wake up about midnight and you're sick as hell and you think your window's down, but it's up? You heave right into your window. You knock the hell out of your head. And then I'd sit there and roll the window down. Squish, 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 comes the window, right? And then you wonder, why don't I ever roll it down before I heave on it, I wonder? These are complicated problems for alcoholics. And so now I got to go home. I got to wash my car out. On the way home, you have a flat tire. That ever happened? But if you're an alcoholic and you're half drunk, you never change them. You drive on them. Is that the way it goes? Because you know everything that's disagreeable in your life will go away, right? So you just drive on it, and it goes away. The tire disappears, and you are now driving on the rim. And we call them rim drivers here in AA. It's very significant because it acts as an alarm system for the neighbors. They hear you coming a block away. They run out into the street to get all the kids the hell out of the way so you don't run over anybody. You pull that car into the driveway, open the door, you fall out. You lay out there for an hour or so and you get up and you say to yourself, "I wonder if anybody saw me." Yeah. Alcoholics have a deep concern about their reputation. We worry so much about what people think about us that we lay around on the lawn. In the hedge, maybe. They're bad, I might add. Hedges are very difficult. When you fall into a hedge dead drunk and they get stuck in your clothes and you can't get out, you know. I fell in one in Phoenix. I had the feeling I might die there, you know. I couldn't. Well, you can see under these conditions that I existed under, why not much booze was drinking was done around that home. Red and I, we had a violent 8 years. All that booze was done on them gin mills. It would have been anyway because I'm a bar drinker. I always was. I like the bars. I like the dark lights and the rotten music that hammered at you in there. I like all them intellectual giants that sat around and talked and solved the problems of the universe. I like sitting there about midnight and you kind of get that Maybelline look. You know, kind of wide-eyed. And you're looking in that mirror. In that mirror. God, I love the mirrors. It's just, you devil, you, there you are. You know? It's incredible how good looking you got, isn't it? You wonder why all them dollies aren't down here, man. Are you good tonight? And you're well built. Look at that arm, you killer, you, yeah. 150 ringing wet in those days. I couldn't lick my lips, let alone anybody else. That whiskey makes a lover and a killer out of you. You get so drunk, you can't remember what you are. Well-built, good-looking, intellectual and wealthy. $30 smiling Frankie Gordon suit on. 50 cents worth of chili right down the front of you there, huh? Alkies love chili. You smell bad, you can't talk, you mumble, you fall off the bar stool, you go to the men's room and it's a pay toilet and you haven't got the money to get in, and it's another problem in your life and you got to slide under the door, and I know there's some door sliders here. Then you slide out again and you didn't even know. God, once you got in, all you had to do was just turn the handle and walk out. Now, the alcoholic, you know, if he goes in one way, he comes same way. That's the way he's got it. And we walk on down that road, and we laugh a great deal about it today, but as we're going down, we're grinding out every loving thing we own. It means anything in our life. That whiskey was getting it all. Hell, you're an alcoholic, you continue to drink, it's just a matter of time until you stand there and you're tapped. There's nothing. Sure, the people I worked for, the people I did business with, I finally lost the respect. You see, the old Yugoslavs, they sold out in 1951. Sold to an Eastern firm. By 1953, well, these responsibilities, one by one, were taken away from me. Finally, they told me, in no uncertain terms, that I would never, ever leave Los Angeles County again for that company. Never. You'll never go out. We'll send people out on jobs that are half as good as you think you are, Norm. We can depend on them. You're to the point we can't depend on you. Image was a big thing with this Eastern firm. And they laid it on me. And after I had that trouble in Texas, why, they really told me, they said, the next time we even smell booze on your breath, you're out of here. Now get out of my office. Humility, humiliation. We could write volumes. What the hell, we've been humiliated so many times. How I want to reach over and how I want to grab him by the throat and how I want to tell him. I want to say, who are you? Who are you, you Johnny-come-lately? I'm the guy that makes it go. I drive the line. I'm the backbone of the division. Who are you to tell me? I'm going to fix your wagon. I'm going to quit your rotten company. I'm going to open up my own company. I'm going to run you out of business. You're going to have to come down to see me for a job. You're going to walk in my office. And I'm going to say, I remember you. Now you get the hell out of here. Yeah. And that's what I told all the guys at the bar that night. Yeah. Told them all just what I told him. And you know, and I know, I told nobody anything because I'm scared, because I'm living on the edge, because I'm coming from behind, because I got the heat on, because I got to have the job, because I got to buy the whiskey, and I don't tell anybody anything. Nothing. Always, though, the rationale. One day I'm going to get him. One day. And then one day I drive home, and the message is theirs. Always able to scheme. One more lie, one more promise. Old Red let me in. One more day, standing there going, baby, give me a break. Don't throw me out. Think of the kids. I'm going down to see the priest. They're going to take another pledge. Baby! Jesus, the schemer. Then one day, no more scheming, huh? One more day. One day, they come to the point where she says, Norm, you're a drunken bum. She wasn't even sore at me. You're a drunken bum. You'll never live to be 35 years old. You're drinking yourself to death. Hell, I'm a neurotic. I'm a neurotic. Look at all the kids here. They're neurotics because of you. What's it like, Norm, to sit here year after year looking through the front room window waiting to see a car come home? No, night after night after night. What's it like to hear a siren scream the streets? And I think, God, they've got you. Or maybe this time it's not going to be so good. Maybe they're scraping you up off the street because you're dead out there. Shit, I just can't go down through it any longer. I can't tolerate these things. You're going to have to get out of my life. I find it necessary to call an attorney and ask for separate maintenance and put a restraining order against you and divorce you, and now you must go. I'd like to be able to tell everybody here that everything works out all right. come to the program and everything is reunited. But that is what we offer, you know. We don't guarantee anybody's going to make a ton of scratch or drive a big iron or live a big house on the hill or your woman or your man's ever coming in. That isn't what we have. Sobriety and a way of life, that's what we have. Whatever you are, you'll be better at. That's what we have. You're a ditch digger, you'll be a better ditch digger. That's what we got. But there are people, you know, stick around for 20 years, always hoping this jackass is going to straighten out. Can you believe that? Hell, I wouldn't put up with it 20 days. 20 years they watch him flop in and out of the house. 20 years of picking up the pieces. 20 years of lying. 20 years of promises you can't make. 20 years of hearing, telling friends and relations, don't come over. Norm's got the flu. He flew right under the bed. That's what he flew. God knows I wouldn't put up with it. But there are people who put up with it. And the miracle comes to pass, doesn't it, when they walk through the doors into these meetings and the thing sticks and stays. What a miracle that is. See a guy coming in sick. Seeing a woman coming in sick. Seeing the same people 4 or 5 months later and are sharped out and the guy's looking good. Eyes are clear. And a woman's eyes have changed too, if that be the case. And in her eyes, there's a story and it never changes. It says, I've been waiting 20 years. 20 years for this to happen and finally it's happening. Today we're happier than we've ever been in our life. And it's all made possible through a unique miracle you and I choose to call Alcoholics Anonymous. That isn't necessarily the way it's going to be, you or new out there this evening. These are the miracles of the program. I ground it down until there wasn't anything left. Till no more. And I totally surrendered. People have said to me, well, when do you hit that surrender point? What does it take? It takes losing the respect of yourself as an individual, as a human being. I got to believe that. I think the best interpretation, the best answer to that question I ever heard was a friend of mine many years ago, I called on him, took him to his first meeting. He stayed around for a year or so and then he went back out. And he drank out there for about a year. Then he came back. And I asked him the question. I says, Bob, what the hell brought you back? I said, what took you down to that point of total surrender? He says, Norm, I'm sitting down in Main Street at Skid Row in L.A. And this guy's got a big job with a Firestone company. And he says, I'm down there with three or four cronies that I'd met there. We're drinking two-bit whiskey. These three guys want to run me for mayor, and I ain't interested. And I thought, yeah, that would be the total surrender point. Because when you're at them gin mills and they want to run you for something, you're going to go, right? Well, I got down to that point of no return. And inside, I had nothing going. Because the respect of myself was gone. A man walked into my life one day and said, you have abused the privilege of owning it. And he took it away, the respect of myself as an individual. I found it virtually impossible to wash my face and shave in the morning because I had to look at me. I could kid every man jack on the street out there, but I got to the point that I couldn't kid myself anymore. I became that psychological second, sick and tired of being sick and tired. Call it what you will. God directed, I'm sure. I got up off of the floor. It was February 1954. I walked in. I pick up a telephone. I call the central office in Los Angeles. I talked to a guy over there, and his name was Johnny. Johnny C. was one hell of a guy, one of the greatest men I've ever met in my life. He passed on after he'd been sober a couple of years. I related to him that I thought I had a drinking problem. And he said, if you got a drinking problem, son, I'm going to tell you something flat out. You never have to take another drink again if you don't want to. He said, I'm going to give you some phone numbers. I want you to write them down. I want you to give yourself a break. I want you to call them. I want you to keep calling until you get a hold of a guy and he'll be out to see you. And he'll probably take you to some meetings. Don't close the door. And so I called. I got a hold of a guy and he said, hang in. I'll be out in a couple of hours. And I waited. And he came out and he sat down. And my sponsor was one of these hard-hearted sponsors you hear about in AA. And I'm not saying this is the right way, but I'm not saying it's a wrong way either. I'm saying this is the way the program was brought in. He says, Alcoholics Anonymous, son, is a program for people that want it. And you got to want it as bad as you wanted anything in your life. You got to want it as bad as you wanted that whiskey, and if you don't want it that bad, then what in the hell are you doing coming to AA? You're wasting our time, and you're wasting your time. Any length to get it. If he said it once, he said it a half a dozen times. I really didn't like this guy. Right from the very beginning, I didn't like him. He also said, I'm not going to pick you up and take you to meetings. He says, there's guys in the city who'll pick you up and they'll take you to meetings, but not me. He says, hell, that's a soft, easy way. How many times did you walk for whiskey, boy? You can walk for this thing if you haven't got the money to take a bus and you haven't got a car. He says, I'm telling you something else. If you've got a car, what the hell are you doing in AA anyway? You're premature. But he says, here in the last couple of years, I'll tell you something, we've softened up a lot. We've been taking chances on guys that own cars, and a lot of you guys are making it, by God, yeah. And that was his attitude. And so that night, I could hardly wait to go to a meeting. I wanted to go to a meeting in spite of him. I wanted to go to a meeting in spite of myself. I wanted to go to a meeting to prove to somebody I could drive that far, maybe. Or show him a car. Or run over him with my car. I kind of thought that'd be nice, too. I wanted to get down there. I didn't want that old guy to think that I couldn't make it that far, by God. That angel on my shoulder, the old shooter wasn't snapping it off. He gave me a shot. He gave me a chance. God directed. And I pulled into that old Temple City meeting I met down in Rosemead in those days. Pulled into the parking lot, and my God, there he was. He was waiting for me. And he walked up to the car, and he opened the door. And I got out, and he put his arm around me, and we walked in. And I loved him. God, I loved him from that day till the day he died. What a controversy he was, obviously. You liked him or hated him, there was no middle roads with it. He carried the message to thousands of people. He was a tremendous speaker on this program. Who knows how many people he's helped out there? Thousands. There's no question about it. The guys like me are here today because of guys like him. Lots of us. But what a controversy. He had a very difficult time. He had a very difficult time accepting all aspects of the program. Turning his will and his life over the care of anybody on an all-time basis. Couldn't do it. Direction. He wanted to be the director. Tolerance. A God-given quality that says, let another man live his life the way he wants to live it. Not the way I want him to live it. He couldn't do that. He wanted to be the director in and out of the program. People wouldn't do it. He got resentful. Resentments. Luxuries alcoholics can't afford. The resentments ate him alive. And after 8 years, that old 8-year syndrome. And he walked out the door one day and he drank himself some whiskey. And he stayed out there 12 years. Now, God knows he tried to get back time and time again. He tried to get back, but he couldn't make it. Each and every time he come in, his ego wouldn't let him stay. His ego said, I'm the guy that carried the message to help the people. All of the people I have sponsored are now my sponsor, and he would go back out. We had some conversations in those years. And then he had a heart attack, severe, it drove him to his knees. Physically, he couldn't make it, and he came back, and he had a year and a half. And in that year and a half, God, what a time we had. At the end of the year and a half, he died. He's always been my sponsor. He's my sponsor today. He was my sponsor when he was drinking. Because he was the guy that took the time to come to see me. He's the guy that carried that message. He's the guy that met me down there at that Temple City meeting. Pulled in that parking lot and he took me in. 80, 90 of the finest drunks ever came out of San Gabriel Valley at that meeting, let me tell you. We were a very wealthy group, that group, at that time. We had so much money in the group, we had donuts before and after the meeting. That's hard to believe, but... and we had red jelly donuts. We didn't have them plain, rotten old donuts, man. We had them red jelly donuts. They're very expensive. They're so good for new people. A new guy comes through the door, and he's all green and hung out. And the red jelly donut committee would slide up on him there, you know. Nice to have you here. You're new, aren't you? Have a donut. Oh, God, no. Did you ever look at a red jelly donut when you got a hangover? God, it'll make your teeth itch, I'll tell you that, yeah. And the meeting began. That night, it was a little bit different. That night, an entire group was putting the meeting on. It was a group from the old L.A. Central Avenue group. A guy by the name of Tokay, he was one of the speakers. A guy named Fred Mundell was... leading the meeting, a gal by the name of Willa May, letter carrier named Bucky. A couple others that I can't remember doesn't make any difference, but the letter carrier, he was the guy. He was the guy that stood up there and said that he hadn't found it necessary to take a drink, steal it, and go to jail now for 9.5 years. He was the guy that I was impressed. He was a street man out of L.A., and I could savvy the streets, and I knew what he was talking about. But he'd been so far, you know. I hadn't been as far as he. In the beginning, I understood and I identified, but the more he talked, I lost that identification because I hadn't been way down that road. And I got to think, you know, what the hell, I'm not that bad. I'm underqualified. This guy's been in 70, 80 jails and he drank this Jamaica ginger, which had given him the Jake leg. I'd never heard of that. You know, it crippled him up. So I had to put him in a hospital for 2 months. Everybody was hysterical over the fact the guy couldn't walk. Ain't that funny? Oh, God, that's so funny. I'm a sponsor. Did you hear that? An army can't walk. Oh, yeah, that's great. You know, I really didn't think it was all that funny. As I made mention, I'd lost identification because I hadn't been that far. You know, 25 jails at the outside. That's all I'd ever been in. And I drank a little Vitalis from Sneaky Pete. Compared to him, you know, what the hell is that? That is nothing. But the man made a very profound statement that night. He said, it doesn't make any difference what you drank or where you drank it or how much you consumed. He said, it's what it's doing to you. He said, if it's tearing up any part of your life, you don't have to go through that again, ever. And the one thing, and probably the only thing I took away from that meeting that night was that I never had to hurt myself again. That I didn't have to go through it anymore. Why did I know? I knew because he hadn't. How do I know he was telling me the truth? All he had to do was look at him, you know. What the hell, I understood street people. And that guy was not a street man, he was a man. That's what he was, a man among men who stood there that night. He was exceptionally clean, whose eyes were clear, who laughed a great deal, who was dressed good. And he had a set of threads on, probably cost him $100. And I'm thinking to myself, if he didn't get nothing else out of AA, what a set of drapes. Boy, that's all right. I might hang in a little while. I might have another issue going down. And I'd already seen a couple of marks could have been hustled. So there was a lot of potential there in that group. And I'm thinking, maybe I will stay around a while. And then he says, if I can do it, you can do it. And I'm thinking he's talking to me. And I'm saying, yeah, what the hell, if he could do it, anybody could do it. His life had been compounded by the fact that his woman had divorced him and remarried, and all his kids, they all hated him. But he said one day a miracle came to pass, and he bought the package of the program. And he had a change of attitude, and his kids came down to see him. They learned to like him, to respect him, and they loved him. And if I'd have looked around, I'd have seen it. I'd have seen the tough guys, the 200-pound, six-footers sitting in the meeting, and the tears screaming down their face, and they cried, and they were unashamed. The big tough guys, the hay shakers out of South El Monte and Garvey Acres, crying. The story was there. I didn't recognize it that night. Later on, I understood that they would cry because they were miserable. Yes. Or they would laugh because they were miserable. And they would cry because they were happy. And they would call it AA. Through the laughter, I discovered a way to clear out the wreckage of my past and the wreckage of the future when it walks down to see me, what it come to be. Through the laughter, I found a way to make a transition, to move on out. To quit taking and start giving. I basically am a taker of things and a user of people. I'm a loser. All takers are losers. You look at the one right here. I had absolutely nothing in my life until I learned to have something you must give. AA is a program of giving. You didn't buy it, you can't sell it, you can only give it to them. You gotta give. Give. Yeah, the reward is insurmountable. Not something in a material sense, but in a sense of well-being, we guarantee you the world. A sense of well-being inside that explodes. Because you help the guy to help himself to get in another day. That is the total reward. These are things, obviously, that I didn't take away from this first AA meeting. Matter of fact, the second meeting that I went to was damn near the last. My sponsor said, we're going to a meeting in Pasadena tomorrow night. And I said, well, there's got to be another meeting. He said, Pasadena's a rotten town, don't you understand? He said, no, I always go to Pasadena on Monday night. If you want to go, fine. If you don't want to go, don't go. And God, I'm aggravated. No, and I thought, what the hell? He don't think I can go to Pasadena. I'll show him I can drive to Pasadena. And I went again. I went over to Pasadena. There was this old-timers meeting over there, the Villa Street Group. You had to be sober 10 years to read the steps. The speaker that night been in AA 137 years. Yeah. He was a real old-timer. And when he talked, he stood up in front of the group. And I learned to love old Artie, But when he talked, old Artie stood up there and he showed a picture of himself, and it was a great big blown-up mugshot taken on when he's doing time in the county jail. And the point that he tried to get across, he says, look at me when I'm drinking. Look at me now. And I looked at that picture. I looked at Artie. And I thought, Christ, he looked better drunk, that poor bugger did. Yeah. I got to get the hell out of this AA. They age these people. Yeah, and the next day on the way to work, I'm coming down Arrow Highway into Baldwin Park in Irwindale. Tony's liquor store, and I had an account there. Made a left turn in. I says, Tony, give me a pony. And she gave it to me. And I took it out of the car, and I cracked it, and I took a long drag. The next thing you knew, I threw it away. And from that day to this, it hasn't been necessary to take a drink. God moving in strange ways in my life again. For my sponsor said 3 meetings that he would go to with me, and he would introduce me around to a lot of people. He would make sure that I had a book. He says, you get a hold of 3.5, and you buy the book. We don't serve credit. You hustle 3.5 of the booze, you can hustle 3.5 of that book. And he said, I expect you to have it. The third night. Arcadia. Tuesday night meeting. And so I went to that Arcadia meeting, and I walked in, and immediately I met 6 guys. Young guys. Guys from 26 to 36. And we all started running together at that time. You know. We started having meetings after the meetings, because they're the best kind. You got a lot of in-depth inventories taken that way. We noticed there were a lot of flakes in AA. We noticed there were a lot of cliques in AA, too. So, by God, we formed our own clique to be against the other cliques. You know how that is. We also noticed they had a lot of bad secretaries in AA. So we decided we would run one of our guys for secretary, and we would get this damn thing straightened out. But we had to wait a year. You had to have a year of sobriety before you could run for secretary. But we hung in and we waited. And then one of our guys, the old Pollock, he got a year in. We run him for secretary on election night. We went down to Baldwin Park, El Monte. We imported a bunch of friends of ours. They say no politics in AA. Don't you believe that, But by God, on election night, our boy became secretary. It was a landslide election. And a week later, he joined the other cliques. Yeah. Hell yeah. Then you get to looking around, don't you? Huh? What do you find? You find the only cliques in AA is the click, click, clicking in your head. You can have anything in AA you're big enough to have. There's people I wouldn't stay sober with. People I wouldn't do any drinking with. People I'm not going to share all my sobriety with them. They're not going to share theirs with me. Goes without saying. Many people wouldn't get drunk or do any drinking with me, so the thing has got to be in the opposite. But a man told me years ago, and his name was Glenn C., and he says, "No, I'm going to tell you something flat out, son." He said, "There's not a man or a woman in this program would dislike you so bad he'd like to see you take a drink." Now, isn't that a hell of a deal? He says, "Norm, he may hate your guts, but call him up and say, 'Charlie, will you come down and see me? I got to have some help. I got to talk to somebody.'" He would be down and he would sit there and he would try and guide and to help because he wouldn't want to see you go out in that jungle and get torn up one more time in that grinder. He would go to any length to make this possible, and that's got to be one hell of a deal. And I'm a guy that looks half the world out there trying to find the best deal. And I didn't find it, not until I got here, until I was surrounded and subjected by this wonderful group of people who would call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would love to tell you here tonight. And in these 27 years and 6 months that I've been around, that every day's been a holiday and every meal's been a banquet. But that isn't what they promised me, as I well told you. They gave me the sobriety and a way of life. They gave me the equipment and the strength to stand out there and be counted. They gave me the book and they gave me the friends and they gave me the numbers. They said, "You're going to take the good days, you love them, and I love them.
You're going to have to take the bad ones too, because that's the way it is. The heartbreak, the grief, and the misery. And they're the difficult, aren't they?"
In 1962, and I run into this without knowing, the 8-year syndrome. And my 8-year of sobriety was the worst. Jesus. I let my ego overrule my good sense. I made a lot of bad deals. Financially, I was in the worst shape in my life. I couldn't hit a lick. Everything I touched turned to pucky. You know the kind of deal. I had a bad program going. I have an honest desire to take a drink. I can taste the whiskey going down. I can taste it going down all year. Periodically, I got that desire. The next thing you know, I'm sitting in the gin mill in Miami Springs. I'm down there on business. And the bartender's saying, "What do you have?" And I said, "A double." And there it is, like that. But for a moment. Yeah, but for the grace of God. He took me back for a second to remember who the hell I am and where I came from and what brought me to this point in my life. He maybe said, "It isn't that bad. I'm making you a little stronger, Norm, for what's coming later on." And later on it came, and I stood in front of St. Luke's Hospital, and I said, "Me, Jesus Christ, why? You're trying to get my woman." "Yeah, you've already got a couple of kids." "Jesus, why?" I couldn't believe that these things happen to people like me. These things happen to everybody else. Is that the way it is? I felt I should have some kind of an exemption. I'm 8 years sober. Give it to the new guy. Jesus, don't give it to me. I'm up the air with it. Yet inside, what the hell you know? Inside, the old shooter, he's kind. He never gives you more than what you can carry, does he? Isn't that the way he cuts it? He gives the big loads to the big horses, and the small ones he's always giving the guys named Norm. Instead of standing around crying a poor mouth about what you didn't get, you better learn to say thanks for what you got. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the 27 years and 6 months that you let me walk out there on the sunny side of the street. Because, hell, I know guys that died. They died. They never saw 27 days. The guy that brought the program to me in 1946, old Sully. Yeah, he had 3 years. He went back out, and he flipped in and out. Several years ago, his sister-in-law called me, and she's on the program. She says, "Norm, this is Ginger. Norm, I hate to tell you, Sully was drunk this week, and he had an internal hemorrhage, and he bled to death, Norm, because nobody was there, Norm." And I cried again, and I thought, Jesus, why does it have to be? Why do guys have to go out and prove to people like me that you can't make it? That once an alcoholic, you die an alcoholic. Why do guys got to go out and take it out clear to the bitter end and the hard way with the screws down and the heat on? And the pathetic part of it is that he had to justify his existence to the bitter end. He had to justify because he was coming from behind. The alcoholic is always coming from behind. And so he had to justify each and every damn thing he did right down till they put him out. How lucky am I that I haven't had to do that? How lucky am I that I've been able to walk the streets and feel the sun? How lucky am I that I've been able to stand in solitude and cry a little bit about things that are unhappy and disappointing? And cry a great deal because I'm extremely happy for another man because he's happy. How lucky am I to work a job, be able to go home when the day is over? To have a couple of sons that are my business partners today. To have daughters that I've walked down the aisle one by one, and I've watched them marry. To have daughters that prior to their marriage that I've taken downtown. And I bought them their first pair of high-heeled shoes. Now that doesn't sound like a hell of a lot unless you missed it. Then you know what I'm talking about. To watch a chicken become a woman. The chickens of my life became the women of my life. And I cry. Because women attract jackasses. And jackasses come around to my house and they take out my women. And they are jackassier every year or I'm getting older. I don't know which it is. I still got one left of the house. She's 17. She's the caboose. They're still coming around. They make me want to throw up sometimes, yes. But as I made mention, I'm really extremely fortunate from the standpoint that her sisters, I was able to marry off. I was able to walk them through the down the aisle. I was able to watch them come out dressed in white crying, and they make me cry. And I walked the whole church and cried. And I looked out and saw my Elkie friends out there, and they were crying. Them Elkies are sentimental people, aren't they? We'd go to a supermarket opening, we'd cry, wouldn't we? Hell yeah. And we're all crying, I'm thinking, for the same reason, because of this jackass them girl is marrying up there. But it isn't all that bad. My son-in-laws are working. All of them are working and taking baths, huh? I got one's a driller in the oil business. I got another's a dentist. I'm going to have teeth and gas any way you want to look at it, huh? Yeah. I got 5 granddaughters that ripped the hell out of my house, put peanut butter in my slippers. I got a grandson that's going to be here in November. And I... And I could go on to tell you many things that have occurred in my life. Many of the miracles of this program. But there's never adequate words. I can only tell you, buddy, if you knew that every loving thing I got is because of AA. And any loving thing I'll ever be in my life is going to be because of the program of the people. I can also tell you it's been a long walk from Lincoln Heights in the L.A. County Jail to the point that I stand today. And but for the grace of God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and friends like you, I could have missed it all. Thanks to me, and God bless you.